You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, immigration helped shape the United States, but the history of immigration in the country has seen a lot of back and forth in laws and in public opinion. In day two of our series looking at immigration in the United States, a historian gives us some of the background for today's immigration debate. First, President Trump picked his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court last night. The nominee is Brett Kavanaugh, a 53-year-old federal appeals court judge who has a long history of work in D.C. politics. His resume includes time working for President George W. Bush and Special Prosecutor Ken Starr during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. For the last 12 years, he's served as a judge.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
Kavanaugh's nomination is the first step in what's likely to be a tough confirmation process in the Senate, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court? Do you think Kavanaugh would be a good justice? And what do you want Wisconsin's two U.S. senators to do? What do you want them to vote on this confirmation process? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kimberly Robinson is the legal editor for Bloomberg BNA and their lead Supreme Court correspondent. She's with us now from Washington, D.C. Kimberly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, and his background.
Well, for all of President Trump's talk about draining the swamp, in his Supreme Court nominee, he's picked a true Washington insider through and through. Not only has Brett Kavanaugh been on the federal appellate court that sits here in D.C. for the last 12 years, but he was actually born and raised in D.C. and the Maryland suburbs. You know, he spent a little time out of D.C., of the D.C. area, when he went to Yale undergrad and law school and did a few clerkships, but he's returned since then and has held a number of very prominent positions within conservative governments.
And he's been there at some key moments in American political history, the Bush-Gore 2000 election standoff. He was on the Bush side of things on the legal team. He was on, as we mentioned, Ken Starr's team during President Bill Clinton's administration. He's been there in some controversial moments.
Well, that's right. And that's actually one of the reasons that his nomination to the D.C. Circuit stalled for so long. He waited for confirmation for 3 years, in part because of his place in these very political matters. In fact, Chuck Schumer, who's now the minority leader, said that he was at every principal partisan battle in modern history. And that was one reason why he thought that he shouldn't even be on the D.C. Circuit.
Can you talk a little more about the case President Trump was making on behalf of Brett Kavanaugh right up front here?
Well, what he really highlighted from Brett Kavanaugh is that he is a judge who calls himself an originalist. And that's somebody who interprets the Constitution as it was originally understood to be. Brett Kavanaugh has explained that he does that in order to avoid inserting his own political desires into his judicial rulings. But the president also emphasized that Kavanaugh is a textualist. He's somebody who sticks very close to the text of the statute. And I think that's something that is going to come into play quite a bit when he's ruling on administrative agencies and trying to rein in their power.
Talking to Kimberly Robinson, legal editor for Bloomberg BNA, about President Trump's second nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. Let's look a little more at Judge Kavanaugh's background. Can you talk about his role in the George W. Bush administration?
Well, he was on the front lines of the Florida recount in 2000, and that's something that really ingratiated him to the Bush administration, something that really invited him back into the Bush White House.
And how about his work with the special prosecutor? What did anything stand out as far as Kavanaugh's role in the investigation of President Bill Clinton?
Well, yes, he actually worked with Ken Starr, whom he actually had met in a previous position in a fellowship at the Solicitor General's office, which is, of course, the federal government's top lawyer at the U.S. Supreme Court. And while working with Ken Starr at the Office of Special Counsel, he was deeply involved in the investigation over Vince Vaughn's suicide, and also was one of the major drafters of the case for impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Now, a lot of focus will be on his work as a judge, and he's built up a long record on the Court of Appeals. What kind of things are people looking at to see, to read the tea leaves of how he might vote on controversial issues?
Well, when I spoke to opponents last night following the president's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, I really heard three major points that it seems like the opposition is going to be looking at. And that's how Brett Kavanaugh has voted in abortion cases, how he's voted on the Affordable Care Act, and also how he will vote in LGBT rights cases. These really seem to be the themes that I heard over and over again that opponents are going to be looking to his previous work to see how he might vote once he's on the Supreme Court.
And he's going to be replacing Justice Anthony Kennedy, who's generally viewed as a conservative or maybe a libertarian, but he voted with the liberal part of the court on some of those social type issues you just mentioned, right?
Well, that's right. And I think that's why this nomination feels different from President Trump's first nomination, is because there seems to be so much more at stake. You know, Neil Gorsuch, the president's first nominee, was replacing a true conservative who voted with the conservative bloc of the court almost every issue. Justice Kennedy is seen as a swing justice. He has voted with the liberals in some very key social issues, most notably abortion, affirmative action, and gay rights. But I do think it's important to remember that Justice Kennedy was a deeply conservative justice. And in fact, we saw that play out this term, where the court actually split 5-4 in 18 cases. And Justice Kennedy wasn't with the liberals in any of those cases.
And speaking of Justice Kennedy, this is another nominee who had clerked, and this is a big deal in Supreme Court pedigree, had clerked for Justice Kennedy, right?
Well, that's right. And this is actually the first time where we see a majority of the justices who were actually previously clerks on the Supreme Court. This wasn't something that what had been a particular resume marker that was essential for Supreme Court nominees, but it seems to be now. And indeed, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, Justice Kennedy will have two of his clerks on the Supreme Court, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch.
Want to give a listen as we start to turn to the confirmation process now to Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. He talked to reporters this morning in a teleconference. Here's what he had to say about Kavanaugh's nomination.
I'll keep an open mind. I want to, now that Judge Kavanaugh has been named the nominee, I want to take a look at his record as well. I want to meet with him and discuss exactly his approach to the law. But early indications are, from my standpoint, very favorable.
What kind of reaction, apart from Senator Johnson, are you hearing from Senate Republicans?
Well, I think that Senate Republicans are very happy with this nominee. We heard a little bit of squabbling about Judge Kavanaugh not being conservative enough, looking at a couple of his cases, most notably his vote over the Affordable Care Act. But it's hard to tell if that was really, somebody just trying to push forward their nominee, or if it was just trying to confuse us all away from Brett Kavanaugh, who really from the beginning has been seen as the front runner.
Talk about the process now. Once upon a time, not that long ago, it would take 60 votes to confirm a Supreme Court justice. No longer true, right?
Well, that's right. You know, the Democrats had jettisoned the filibuster requirement requiring 60 votes for lower court nominees, not doing it for the Supreme Court. And Majority Leader McConnell said that they would come to regret that, and I do believe that now they do. Now Republicans just need a simple majority. They do have an effective 59-49 lead right now.
51-49.
Well, presuming that Senator McCain will be unable to come to Washington to vote due to health care reasons. So the vote is going to be very close in this case.
Talking to Kimberly Robinson, Bloomberg, BNA's legal editor and lead Supreme Court reporter. We're taking your calls and questions at 800-642-1234. Now we have a nominee in place for the U.S. Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, getting ready for the confirmation process. From what you've seen so far about this nominee, what do you think? Are you optimistic about his chances of being confirmed? Do you want him to be confirmed? And what do you want Wisconsin senators, or if you're from our neighboring states, what do you want your senators to do? How do you want them to vote on this confirmation? What kind of issues are you watching? Are you worried or hopeful about changes with a new justice on the court? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Bloomberg legal editor Kimberly Robinson, looking at President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this nomination? What do you want from the Senate when it comes to looking at Brett Kavanaugh's record and deciding whether or not to confirm him? And are there issues you're watching and thinking might change, whether you like that change or not? Things like abortion, same-sex marriage, affirmative action. Are you hopeful or fearful that the new lineup on the Supreme Court, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, will change things? Call 800-642-1234. Also, when and if you voted in the presidential election, was this issue, Supreme Court nominees, part of why you voted the way you did? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. To your calls now, Carol is with us in Madison. Carol, hi.
Oh, hi there. I am just calling because I'm just wondering why this president is even able to put forth a nomination right now for the Supreme Court, given that he is currently under, or he's actually the subject of a criminal investigation.
Carol, thanks for the call. That's some Democrats nationally are making a similar case while the Russia probe is going on. Is that something you're hearing from Democrats at all, Kimberly?
We are hearing that a little bit. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that there's really anything that Democrats who think that that's the way to go can do about it. They don't really seem to have the numbers to stop Leader McConnell from going forward with a vote on that basis, at least.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call. Is there anything, procedurally there really is, if, as you say, if Republicans all vote the same way, is there anything Democrats could do to slow the process down?
Well, there is something they can do to slow the process down, and that was actually one of the reasons why McConnell had kind of nudged the president against voting for Brett Kavanaugh, and that is to take a really hard and close look at the documents that Kavanaugh produced while he was in the Bush White House. That's something that can stall the nomination, but it's unlikely to stop the nomination, and there does seem to be enough time, even with those stalling tactics, to get the confirmation done before the midterm elections.
Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Sparta. John, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I've been listening to the news quite a bit, but Mitch McConnell was adamant about Obama not getting a judge sitting before the election. And I wonder why it was okay then, and there's not an uproar that he's appointed one, and they adamantly want him seated right away. And I just want to know, where is the outcry?
John, thanks a lot for that call. I think a lot of Democrats bringing up the name of Merrick Garland and his non-confirmation back before the 2016 election. What are you hearing?
Yeah, that was the first line of criticism against, the president really nominating anybody, that this would be the height of hypocrisy. McConnell and other Republicans have said that, the dividing line was a presidential election year and this is a senatorial election year. I think in reality, it was really a fake rule to begin with. And so what line it falls on, if it's a new fake rule, it's just really up to who has the votes.
Thanks a lot for that call. And yeah, it seems whatever party's in control, they are willing to make procedural changes on their behalf, whether it, as you mentioned, Senator Reid getting rid of the filibuster for lower court judges, Leader McConnell now setting his own precedents. Whoever runs the Senate seems to be taking the rules in their own hands now.
That's exactly right. And we just see a complete flip-flop on both sides of what the arguments were for and against, President Barack Obama's nominee and now President Trump's nominees.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. You just answered one of my comments. And the other comment that I was going to have was I think it's a pretty poor choice for the president to be telegraphing his desires in a judge. I mean, you want a judge to be impartial. So saying that I'm going to nominate a judge that's going to overturn Roe v. Wade and be pro-business and all this sort of stuff just seems sketchy to me.
John, thanks for the call. A lot of people kind of dance around the margins, but in effect, isn't that what we're seeing? Presidents looking for judges who will go along with their agendas, Kimberly?
Well, that's right. I can't recall a presidential candidate who was as explicit as President Trump. You know, he said that he would appoint a judge who would automatically overturn Roe versus Wade. But that's something that opponents kept coming back to last night, was that, you know, we don't really see a long record of abortion on Brett Kavanaugh. There is a little bit, but again, not as conservatives of some conservatives would really like. But they say that we have to take this president at his word when it comes to what he's looking for in a judicial nominee. And, you know, he wanted somebody who would overturn Roe versus Wade.
Talking about President Trump's new nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? What hopes or fears do you have about the nominee? How do you want your U.S. senators to vote when it comes to confirmation time? And what issues do you want to see raised along the way in the confirmation process? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kimberly Robinson, our guest, legal editor for Bloomberg BNA and the lead Supreme Court correspondent there. Kimberly, what can we expect now from a confirmation process? What's the public side of this going to look like?
Well, Judge Kavanaugh has already started meeting with senators on the Hill. He met with both McConnell and Judiciary Chairman Grassley today. He'll continue to meet with presumably all senators, or at least attempt to meet with all senators. And then we'll have confirmation hearings, probably about 3 days of confirmation hearings. We'll hear from Judge Kavanaugh himself over 2 days, and then there'll be public testimony. And then a few weeks later, we'll get a vote. Republicans have said that their goal is to get someone seated before the next Supreme Court term starts in early October. But for sure, the goal is to get somebody in there before the midterm elections.
I think summing up a lot of the way these confirmation hearings goes, it's something like this. Senators say, hey, tip us off as to which way you'll vote on a controversial issue X. And the nominee saying, I can't tell you how I would vote on controversial issue X. Do you expect to see a lot of that this time around?
I do, especially around those three issues that I pointed to before, abortion and gay rights and the Affordable Care Act. You know, Republicans say that it's a Ginsburg rule, pointing to what Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said during her confirmation hearings. I do think there will be a few differences from at least the last confirmation process in that, you know, Democrats really focused on the fairness of Republicans holding up President Obama's nominee. And this time around, they really seem to be focusing on issues, perhaps to try and really hammer it home to Democrat and progressive voters that elections matter. And if they want to have a voice in the Supreme Court, they have to vote in these midterm elections.
Let's go back to our callers now. Terry is on the line in Rhinelander. Terry, hi.
Hi. I'm actually driving in a car on the way to Rhinelander. But I just wanted to say that I believe President Trump has the right to nominate a candidate, and I do believe that our senators, both of them, Senator Baldwin, should vote for his nomination. And I just think that in the past, it's something that has been kind of congeniality. This man has nothing dramatically wrong with him, for there's no good reason not to vote for him.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. Kimberly, for as far as resume goes, apart from the partisan politics side of this, Brett Kavanaugh has a pretty solid Supreme Court resume, right?
Well, he does. That has really been the case with almost all of the nominees, with a few exceptions from both parties. We've see nominees who have just these great resumes. And so, you know, the opposition to them really isn't on their resumes, but instead on their policies, or how what people think are their policies, and also, you know, opposition to the president that nominated them. And part of the problem is that, you know, the Constitution is so ambiguous as to what the rules really are, that we've left it largely up to the president and the Senate to sort it out.
Thanks for that call, Terry. We'll go to Dennis now in New Auburn. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Hey, the question I had is, what's kind of scary to me is, you know, like, I'm not a lawyer, and no, I know anything about the law, but when a vote needs to come up on how the Supreme Courts are going to vote, I'm right 90% of the time. All I have to do is pick what type of political party I'm on to. And that's kind of scary, where I can pick who's going, how they're going to vote, and it's 90% of the time they vote political rather than, I don't know if the law is that political, but that's what's kind of scary to me.
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call. Is Dennis being fair to the justices here? You can pick, even though they're not Republican or Democratic justices by name, for the bulk of the time we know which way they're going to vote based on their partisan non-identity?
You know, they are pretty predictable in that regard. I would say that the justices themselves are very concerned about their public image, and that they certainly don't see themselves as political. And I'm not sure that the court is political, but it's just that the justices have judicial ideologies that tend to lead them in these predictable ways.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. Kimberly, what is the timeline now?
Well, I think that, you know, Republicans are moving full force. Again, as I mentioned, Brett Kavanaugh's already started to meet with senators. The expectation is that we'll have confirmation hearings sometime in the fall. Originally, McConnell had said that it would be a stretch to get them done in September, but I think they're going to go ahead and try and do that. You know, we saw Judge Gorsuch was confirmed to justice in just 66 days. So I think that's the timeline that McConnell is really looking for.
So plenty of time for a judge to be done and in place by, say, November's election day.
I think that is the absolute drop-dead date for Republicans.
Kimberly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kimberly Robinson, legal editor and lead Supreme Court reporter at Bloomberg BNA. She was with us to talk about President Trump's Supreme Court pick, his second, Brett Kavanaugh, and the confirmation fight ahead. Now, all this week, we're taking a deeper look at immigration in the United States. The debate over immigration has always been passionate, at times deeply polarizing. For years, the narrative of the United States has been that the fabric of the country is made up in large part of immigrants. Immigrants made up a big part of the population as the U.S. grew to be a powerhouse on the world stage. But shifting attitudes toward groups of immigrants welcomed into the U.S. and the distrust of those excluded help paint a broader picture. Our next guest is here to talk about the history of immigration in America and how past laws have had a ripple effect on policies over the years. Cindy Yifan Cheng is an associate professor of history and director of the Asian American Studies program at UW-Madison. Cindy, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know when we've talked to you in the past, you've looked at the way attitudes toward immigration have changed over the years, and there's really been an up and down cycle over the decades, hasn't there?
Definitely, definitely. And I think much of what's been traced a lot, and I think it still holds, is different economic financial cycles of the nation very much triggers different kind of attitudes towards immigrants and refugees.
We'll dig into some of those economic influences a bit, but how far back do concerns, worries about immigration go in the United States, and even, I guess, maybe even before the United States?
Definitely, definitely. Yes. I think the first, if you go to early America, one of the most clear cases in 1798 is the passage of the four series of laws called the Alien and Sedition Act. And there's always a distrust of the different kinds of political views that immigrants brought with them. But those were largely unenforced. And so for those who are interested in immigration history, the first major federal legislation that was both enforced after it was passed was the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1802. So you really go into the late 19th century, and it's not going to be a surprise because it's during a time of great industrial growth of labor unions, and when that time of great industrial growth, one of the things in certain industry peaked, right, and concerns over loss of jobs for different people. And when resources get scarce, people rely on different values to establish who is more legitimate for certain jobs than others. And what you start to see was a case that started very much in the West Coast in California and became a federal national issue about casting certain people as undesirable, right? And it's interesting because it was during a time where largely the majority of those in the West Coast were foreign born. They were all immigrants. And so you really have a different element in terms of which kinds of immigrants were more undesirable. So those from Europeans were going to be favored. And obviously at that time, with the Chinese exclusion, the immigrants from East Asia were going to be seen as less desirable. And we began that first major federal legislation in 1882 that was enforced to bar Chinese laborers from the United States.
Can you talk, this is 1880 to 1920, people think of as this huge wave of immigration, one of the biggest waves of immigration in American history. Can you talk a little more about the Chinese Exclusion Act in the early 1880s? Mm-hmm. Why, in the midst of, you know, lots of people coming from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, and elsewhere, mm-hmm. why Chinese people were excluded in particular?
Yes. I mean, and I think this, there's two, I'm going to answer this in two ways. One, which is the major waves of immigration, you're right, it's during a time of major immigration, but usually it's European immigration, right? So it also depends on, and it's also going to be largely very East Coast, right? But those who, if you look at the larger federal case, if you consider going on the West Coast, right, and you start to see that the Chinese immigrants that are being brought in to do, first they came for the mining and then to do the railroads. And finally, after the railroads got built, right, then there was an economic recession during this time that hit people widely. Like I said, you really start to see the notion of racial difference really come to play, right, where certain immigrants, even though there's definite cases where Italian and Irish immigrants were going to, and ethnic whites, right, were going to be treated differently. The different levels of animosity towards people, as they at that time called it, like those from a different shore that's outside of Europe, and notions of racial difference would really, really come into play, where there's a different tier, right? The non-white immigrants would have a different kind of immigration history in the United States than European immigrants. And so there was going to be an all-out restriction against Asian immigrants. And it would begin this is when 1882 is when we would also begin the period of immigration exclusion. It was the first enforced federal policy of exclusion. There was one that in 1875, but that to exclude Chinese women mostly, but that wasn't enforced systematically like the 1882 Act was.
Talking to Cindy Yifan Cheng, Associate Professor of History at UW-Madison, looking at the history of immigration policy, laws in the United States, and attitudes toward immigration. And Cindy, I want to not leave the Chinese Exclusion Act. Its lifespan, I understand, was repealed in 1943. Can you talk about the repeal and what went along with that?
Yes, that's also very, very interesting. So what we start to see is that when you look at immigration policy, it's an interesting triangulation, right, between foreign policy interests, the U.S. foreign policy interest, its domestic policy interest, and also the needs of immigrants themselves. And so what we start to see is that during in the 1940s, we're in the midst of a world war. And what the nation realized, right, was that for the U.S. to win the war, the Pacific War, they really needed China to be its ally. The Japanese government did an amazing job in terms of its propaganda, saying, why would China ally with the U.S.? It should side with Japan. It says its exclusion laws names you as inferior. They don't even allow you to be citizens of the United States at this time. Asians were marked as aliens ineligible for citizenship based on race-based qualifications of naturalized citizenship. And so there was so what we start to see is domestic policy of discrimination against non-white immigrants start to have major foreign policy implications and to winning the war. And so in an executive order, they repealed the Chinese Exclusion Act. And there's a famous speech that he made calling this a historic mistake. And you start to see that the United States started to recognize, right, that certain discriminatory categories for immigration was going to be bad for foreign policy. And so you begin the first kind of break in having these biased policies towards immigration towards regulating U.S. immigration. And so I think what the repeal of Chinese exclusion is very, very instructive, right, is that when we look at immigration policy, I think sometimes the confusion is it's not about looking at a policy where there's unchecked, mitigated growth of immigrants. It's about in the policy of immigration enforcement and restriction, is there a more humane, democratic, equitable way of managing and regulating immigration? And so what we start to see is we start to see this first notion of concerns over domestic policy to realize, wow, our favoritism of one country over another in terms of immigration policy will have lasting foreign policy effects. We may want to design an immigration policy that is going to still regulate immigration, still have quotas, but how do we do it in a way that is more democratic, that is more in line with the values that we want to promote, more in line with the image that the United States want to project internationally.
But at the same time as the Chinese Exclusion Act was ending, we have the issue of Japanese internment, Japanese American internment mm-hmm. camps, which mm-hmm. has come up recently in Supreme Court cases regarding yes. bans on travel to the United States from Muslim majority countries. So mm-hmm. one change in one direction and one attitude in a very different direction.
Yes, and I think that they had talked about this as kind of like the split kind of image between Asians. And again, what we start to see is foreign policy reshapes how immigrants in the United States are seen. There's two issues. Definitely, many of these immigrants, they've been in the United States forever, right? For multiple generations.
Right, not really immigrants at that point.
Right, but their skin color would designate them to be seen as what we call the foreigners within. So despite many of these Asian families being in the United States for multiple generations, they're never, because of their skin color at that time, going to be recognized as fully American. And so what you start to see is foreign policy made China an ally. So the kind of immigration status of Chinese Americans were elevated, right? And Japanese, we were at war with Japan, and they became, the Japanese Americans, two-thirds, were actually American-born citizens. Right. They were born in the United States. They were citizens. This is the only country they knew were actually incarcerated because there was a belief and there was a question of their loyalty, despite the fact that the president commissioned a study called the Munson Report that had deemed that Japanese Americans were all loyal, that there was not going to be a concern. And what you also start to see is that it was mostly Japanese on the West Coast that were incarcerated, not those in Hawaii, despite the bombing of Pearl Harbor. So many times when people study Japanese internment, they definitely hone in on the fact that the question of, you know, us taking away rights from American citizens, how race plays into who we think as true Americans and not, right? And how how foreign policy shapes how we view certain groups of people. And the case of Japanese internment has been in the news lately, mostly because of issues around detention, right? Because also what you start to see in the incarceration of Japanese during World War II was the family separation of kids from parents. And so in the recent news, many Japanese American communities have been amongst the most vocal protesting this because they are a community that is still surviving and dealing with the trauma, right, of being separated from their families during the incarceration process in World War II.
We're talking about the history of immigration in the United States, the policies that kept some groups out and let others in, and the long-term impact of those laws. Cindy Yifan Cheng is with us, Associate Professor of History and Director of the Asian American Studies Program at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of immigration in the United States? What do you want to know more about? Are these things that you talked about a lot in school, or is this something that we don't look back and think about enough? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the history of immigration in the United States and the laws put in effect in the past that have shaped policy still today. Cindy Yifan Cheng is with us, Associate Professor of History and Director of the Asian American Studies Program at UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions and thoughts about immigration and its history in the United States. And what do you think about the moment we're in now? Do you see attitudes toward immigration and immigrants changing in the United States and in which direction? If you have immigrated to the country yourself, or maybe you're a second generation, the child of immigrants, love to hear your perspective. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Cindy, turning a little bit to the modern day, some recent polls from Pew and elsewhere have shown changing attitudes on immigration in the United States, people more favorable to it, fewer people saying we need less immigration to the United States, more people saying we need a path to citizenship for people here illegally or unauthorized. But we've got a political movement in some ways in the other direction. Have you seen something like this in the past in American history, where maybe public opinion is moving one way, but there's a powerful group, an anti-immigrant group, I guess, moving in the other direction?
Yes, I mean, most of the major kinds of anti-immigrant things, there does seem to be, I think the general American public are very supportive and understand, and especially in current issues, right, of dealing with notions of, because right now what we're looking at, although they are categorized as undocumented immigrants, it's a very, you know, big category that includes all sorts of different people. And the large portion are asylum seekers, right? They come, and because they have to come to the United States to apply for asylum, there's a long period of time when their status is undetermined. And I think that, and that's why at this time, this grave here, they're undocumented technically, but these are asylum seekers. And I think the majority of American public has always been incredibly in favor of bringing in refugees, right? Understanding the importance of international law, of respecting people who suffer from political persecution, and providing safe refuge for these people. And also understanding U.S.'s role in certain kinds of foreign policies, like in the Vietnam War, right? That part of the consequences of a war like that is that we also have responsibility to those that was displaced because of the war. And part of those responsibility then is to provide safe refuge for Southeast Asian refugees. And with Hmong being the largest Asian American population in the state of Wisconsin, once again, we see a period where the United States understood its political responsibility. And I think the same is true with Latin America. And I think we're seeing a time where I think there's a general understanding of the need for it. But I think there's a different political contingent in Washington these days that is, you know, riding on a very decided anti-immigrant platform.
Another tension in immigration policy over the last bunch of decades involves immigrant labor. And there seems to be this big gray area where a lot of businesses want, in some cases, rely on immigrants to do their labor, authorized or unauthorized. That's runs afoul of the law. It's winked at. Sometimes it's enforced. Is this new, or is this something that we can go back and point to in earlier stages in American history?
Oh, the biggest thing, and is during the with the passage of the 1986 Immigration Reform Act, IRCA, right? Information and Reform Control Act. And this is one of the most interesting period, because we really see, and this is when President Reagan actually granted amnesty, right, for a large portion of undocumented immigrants. They had certain qualifications for it, but this is when we first granted amnesty to many of the undocumented immigrants. And what we find really interesting is, I think it's a very common debate that gets recirculated, right, which is the concern that we definitely understand the importance for labor. And we also, what happens is that there's always this major push, right, that they are taking resources, public services. But every single report, and it is right now, it is the same thing, is that responsible reporting would say, yes, these are the kinds of money that needs to be spent for a certain population. But this is what they give back in terms of taxes. And so what many of these reports have always been doing is they're doing all this work to show that the money that they give back in terms of federal taxes and state taxes is much higher, because they're denied public services by law, right? But they don't get reported. What gets sometimes thrown out for people writing on a very anti-immigrant platform is all the things that money that is being used to spend, right? And the real debate is whether the federal would reapportion, reallocate the surplus tax money back to the states. And that's actually the real fight, right? But I think what we're starting to see right now is a resurgence of that discussion, right? And to understand that the undocumented immigrants have actually contributed much more, has contributed a surplus amount of money to our economy, even though they definitely have taken money away from other kinds of in other sectors, right? But that has to be the reports. And so when President Reagan decided to pass IRCA in 1986, it was based on these figures, right, of understanding that, right, and that state governments were fighting, had fought the fight to get these surplus state, I mean, surplus federal dollars back and reallocated to the states, right? So this is a very common thing, and I think it's very important to kind of note that these fights had taken place for much of the 80s. And in 86, you know, we actually granted amnesty to undocumented immigrants, or at least a good portion of them.
Talking to Cindy Efen Ching from UW-Madison, looking at the history of immigration in the United States. One more issue I wanted to throw at you, Cindy. A recurring theme seems to be a concern that this new group of immigrants, wherever we are in history, for one cultural reason or another, won't fit in a democratic society. That could be groups today. It could be Catholics in the past or non-English speakers in the past. Is this something that you see rise and fall in the immigration argument?
Yeah, I think this just becomes the, you know, for, and this is the thing that's very difficult, right? This is for those who have a viewpoint that, you know, immigration is just bad for the nation. This becomes something that they would latch onto. But I think every single historical movement for every single group would show that over time, these things are very readily worked out, right? People pick up new languages, understand assimilation in its various forms. And over time, that kind of adjustment period isn't as big of a problem. Right. And so I think that most of what these things, all these kinds of concerns and these fears, right, historically, we have seen patterns of them, and we have seen them to be largely overblown and somehow unfounded. I think what's happening is it's misplaced. Right. People are struggling financially. People that working class are working really hard to earn a living. And we want a solution. And the question is, and the easy solution is to believe that there's certain groups of people that's taking something away from my life, right? And I think we have to ask, you know, if we focus on immigrants as a way to solve all of our domestic problems, you know, who are we letting go in this equation? We understand that our latest economic downturn had to do with words like subprime and the mortgage crisis and bailing out the banks and all these things. We understand these larger processes, but sometimes it's hard to grapple and hard to know how to do that. So what we think is we turn to the person next to us and say, you're the reason for why my life is harder. And I think that's a very dangerous thing to do. And I actually think that will have limited consequences, because let's say that did happen and you got rid of all the people you don't like, maybe your economic system may not get better.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Cindy Efen Ching with the UW-Madison joining us to talk about the history of immigration in the United States. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at refugee policy in the United States with Lise Cohen of the UW-Wisconsin-Sheboygan as we continue our conversation about immigration issues here in the United States. That and more tomorrow on Central Time.